This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman. This is London FinTech Podcast, episode 32, and I'm delighted to be joined on the show by Alex Murphy of WorldRemit. WorldRemit is one of the world's leaders in the key sector of online remittances. Remittances, to cut to the chase, is largely the province of often poor migrant workers sending their money home. To date, this has been dominated by large players such as Western Union, who can charge fees of 10 to 20%. Thus, we have the obscene sight of some of the poorest people in the world being charged the highest money transfer rates. Why is this the case? Is this pure capitalist theft, or are there some structural challenges and processes which absorb much of the margin? What can fintech do about it? What is WorldRemit offering that incumbents are not? Generally on these shows, I take a vertical slice and have a CEO of a company to talk about the issue. Nothing wrong and plenty right with that. In this case, though, I'm taking a more horizontal approach. Alex is an expert in mobile money, having worked with telcos around the world, and as formerly at GSMA, which to me sounded like the thing that became 3G when it added a G, but maybe I'm wrong. Before that, she worked in development and for the likes of Grameen Foundation and Aga Khan Foundation, so her background in the issues of, again, let's not beat around the bush, financially poor people, is deep, as is no doubt her desire to help them through new technologies such as fintech. So who better to give us an overview of international remittances in the fintech age? In a fintech slash VC world, where the media narrative is all too often around terms centred purely on greed and flood-up capitalism, hello the unicorn word, it is nice to be able to discuss a firm which is aiming to empower the poorest users of the financial system. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining me today.
I'm glad to be here. It's great to have the chance to be here and to talk about how London isn't just the centre of UK or even European tech and finance. It's actually solving problems for the whole world, and it's perfectly poised. You know, as the world becomes more global and connections across borders and continents become even more immediate, this diversity that we see in London and we see here at WorldRemit are really at the centre of it all.
Well, I saw lots of diversity because at the moment we're in Hammersmith, so I came to Barons Court, which is slightly off my map and somewhat like the third world, although I'm sure full of plenty of people earning lots of money in financial services, although I believe you guys are moving to Victoria, so maybe you are moving more to the heart of things fairly soon.
More to the centre of the universe, yes.
More to the centre of the commuters universe. So talking of international development, in LFP 026, I teased Mike Laven, CEO of Currency Cloud, about his background in international development and subsequent move from helping people to capitalism. And I guess I would tease you about the same, but I think I provided you with a good answer to that in my intro, which is that you haven't really changed direction. So how has the employment journey for you been so far? How did you sort of start by helping people and then end up becoming a mobile money expert?
Well, it's probably been a little bumpier than that, actually, but I'd be curious to know if Mike Laven had a similar experience.
Mike Laven's American, so even if he did, it would sound completely smooth and mellifluous.
Yeah, well, I'm half American, so I can't even, you know, make that claim.
It all sounds half smooth and half honest.
Half smooth and half, you know, mumbling British idiot. But yeah, so, I mean, when I started out in the international development world, I was actually based in Washington, D.C., and I was doing a lot of the kinds of projects that were coming out of the US administration at the time. They were all going to Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And which years were these then, roughly?
Around, you know, even 2009, 2010, so still further on after September 11th, but huge amounts of money being poured in. So there are the types of projects that it's very easy to become very disillusioned with. But, you know, even then, and I had studied, I had done Middle Eastern studies, I was really keen on, I did Arabic for years, Turkish, and then I travelled all around the Middle East. I was really excited about working in policy, or at least I naively thought that that's what I wanted to do. But again, as these projects, you know, kept on coming and you saw the funding slowly dry up as the administration pulled out, it was definitely hard to see where some of these things were going.
Now, indeed, one of my favourite random statistics, I was reading a good book quite a long time ago about the Vietnam War, and I think there was one year, I forgot which it was, in which, on paper, the Americans sent enough concrete into Vietnam to pave the entire country. Now, as Vietnam did not end up paved, a lot of that concrete or the money thereof went missing, so I'm sure there are some sort of challenges in that direction.
Oh, definitely. And I sat in on some of those US Senate hearings, just, you know, but anyone from the public can go and hear these politicians have to answer for some of the funding that was going missing.
Anyway, us Europeans can't talk because the EU accounts have always been qualified and never once added up in its entire history either. So it's all rather similar around the world. So how did that move on to the mobile money then?
So it was actually when I was in Uganda that I, for the first time, really saw something that was real, that people were tangibly, actively using in their daily lives and was helping them to, you know, make it a lot easier, better for them. This was, of course, mobile money, which is a sort of stored value account. I can give a further explanation later.
So the familiar one, of course, is M-Pesa in Kenya. Is that in Uganda as well?
Absolutely. Also in Uganda, also all around the world in over 89 countries. So over 265 services like M-Pesa around the world. But I was in Uganda, we traveled up to the north of the country, which, you know, on these supposedly paved roads on the maps, you know, donor funding again, supposed to be paved, but very much dirt with massive potholes. It takes 6 or 7 hours to get up there. And we'd be talking to these farmers who were nattering away on the phone, finding out the price in this market, finding out the price in this other town. And these middlemen or kind of local farmers as well, who go from farmer to farmer buying their bulk produce, were saying, okay, that's the price. Here you go, I'm sending it now. And that ability to just lock in that spot price at that very moment, have the money appear in the other guy's pocket, you know, miles and miles away, hours away, was really transformative.
So that's real, that's pure capitalism, which you tend not to get in the developed world, which is much more sort of corporatism and state intervention. And it was a level of fintech that was well ahead of what you can get in Hammersmith or Victoria today, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's exactly what fintech is all about here in London, you know, bringing together or refining the asymmetry between information and the speed of money movement, you know, improving that for people ordinarily in their daily lives. It's amazing.
Right. And then that led into GSMA then. And what is GSMA other than something that my phone flashes up when the 3G is not working?
So the GSMA is actually the global trade body for the telecoms industry. So it has, its members are all of the mobile telecoms operators around the world. So companies like Vodafone or Orange or E, 800 members, as well as a lot of the technology providers. So Samsung, Huawei, even Facebook last year joined us as a member.
So is that the group that decides what 3G is, for example?
Yes, definitely. So they were the first, you know, group of operators in Europe that actually got together to hash out the terms of interoperability so that I could actually call you on your network from my other network and send text messages, etc.
Ah, I see. Okay. So moving on to the international remittances then. I mean, firstly, just in terms of clarifying for the audience something other than my unsophisticated understanding. I mean, if I hear international remittances, I tend to think of some Pakistani labourer in Kuwait sending money back to Hyderabad or something like that. Now, clearly that's part of it, but what is the market as a whole?
Well, to a certain degree, you're right, but it is actually a lot bigger and more diverse than that. So international remittances, the industry is huge. The International Organization for Migration says that around 300 million migrants every year move abroad to send to work and to send money back home. The industry is estimated to be around $600 billion a year, around, you know, $640 billion by 2017. What that means is, you know, a lot of these migrants, when they send money home, it's for a purpose. It's to help build a house. It's to put a child through school. It might be their nephew. It might be their own children. It might be the child of an extended family member. And people who go abroad, whether it's as a Pakistani migrant labourer or even as a white-collar worker here in the city, they will have strong ties with their friends and family back home. And often people send money, even small amounts, to many extended family members and many friends. One thing that is universal, though, across the industry, across the international remittances industry to date, is that migrants have been very much overcharged.
Yeah.
And that is especially in the developing world, and partly because of the existing models of incumbents that we can talk about, Western Union, etc.
Okay, so I mean, I'm just thinking back to financial services days. I remember in Hong Kong, I think it was on, probably may still happen, but on a Sunday, all the Amas, all the Filipino maids used to get together in whatever that square was and sit on the floor and have sandwiches and all that kind of stuff. And no doubt they'd be sending back their few Hong Kong dollars to Philippines via some route. And obviously the routes vary, but I mean, Western Union is the one that everybody tends to hear about. So just getting back to my simple question, so why do they charge 10 or up to 20%?
You're absolutely right. The global average is around 6 to 8%. But when you're sending to the developing world, and particularly to Africa or even the Philippines, South Asia, it can be 12% up to 20%. There are a couple of reasons why this is the case, but the thing to remember is that the majority of these remittances, around 95%, are all cash-based. They're offline, meaning that, let's say I'm here in London, I want to send to my family member back in the Philippines, I would be going to visit a high street agent. I'd be taking time off work, because I can only go during business hours. I take a bus to get there, likely have to travel, stand in the queue, hand over cash to the agent, who then takes a commission. And then on the other end, back in the Philippines, my family member would be picking it up. That agent would get a commission. And these are not necessarily the employees of these global money transfer companies. They are high street agents, they might be the post office, but they each get a commission.
So there's a cost of having the infrastructure in the first place. There's cost of Western Union having a million offices around the world or getting the post office to do it. There's cost of transferring the money if you're a, quote, first world person in the first place, moving it from the UK to Europe and all that kind of stuff, which pre the likes of TransferWise, and that cost 5% anyway. So already the numbers are actually kind of totting up as to why it's quite expensive to do it in a, quote, old-fashioned way.
Absolutely. It's a cost-intensive model, and these agents require training. Even their commission structure, when you are handling cash and you don't necessarily know who it is that's handing it over, even if they look dodgy, your incentive is to still take that commission.
Yes. Well, we'll come back to the AML and KYC and all that kind of thing later, because it's a key part of fintech as a whole. So in terms of the trends in the international remittance market at the moment, what is going on? And obviously, I assume that one of the main things is one of the things that's going on is fintechs coming and doing it cheaper and more digitally.
Correct. Yes, remittances are going online, and they're going online very quickly. I mentioned that 95% of remittances are still sent offline. So it's a huge market for us. But when for example, when you come to our website, you come to our mobile app, which is sitting there in your pocket, you can only, when you use our service, you have to have a bank account or a credit card or a debit card to use it.
To import or to output?
To input. We don't take cash as a pay-in method. Yeah. Automatically, you're reducing the AML costs there. Yeah. And with, all of the data that's collected and the data that we have, our customers have to go through an additional KYC process in order to show proof of ID, proof of address, and other different KYC kind of processes in order to make that transaction. And again, depending on the corridor or the country that they're sending to, that actually helps remarkably to reduce the costs.
Okay, and in terms of, technical phrase, you mentioned corridor. So what does corridor mean in non-technical language?
Corridor is simply just from where to where. And it's that channel. In some cases, you have a lot of diaspora communities living in a certain country or even a certain part of a city, and they would be sending mostly to, as I mentioned, the Philippines or to Ghana or to Mexico.
And I don't know much about anything, but I don't know that much about international bank transfers to every country in the world. I mean, other than when I was running fixed interest fund management, there were things like sub-custodians and, all sorts of stuff like that, which I'm glad I never bothered to get involved in. I had a back office to sort it out. But I would assume that connecting, shall we say, somewhere obscure like Hammersmith to every other country in the world is a non-trivial thing that's not always easy. I mean, how easy is it to send money to Afghanistan through Citigroup? I don't know, for example.
So for us, we are a partnerships business. What we do is build, and what we have been doing for the last 5 years, is building up a whole range of partnerships directly with all of these institutions and organizations on the ground. Whether it's, again, let's say Ghana, we work with local banks, we work with local telco organizations, we work with also cash pickup agencies, because those are still options that we want to include in our receive methods. And that ability to work directly with those organizations makes our funding arrangements a lot more instant. And the fact that we can actually call up the organization that we have a partnership with, we have a contract with, and say, hey, what happened to this transaction? Or can you make sure that you have this funding there and ready?
Yeah. So getting back to this corridor thing, on the one hand, you're inputting, and you have to input it via a bank account and be AML'd and KYC'd. On the other hand, as you say, depending on what people are taking it out, they can take it out in a variety of ways, presumably including something like mobile money or cash or a bank account or whatever it exists at the other end. And then presumably the pricing is a function of complexity, and that kind of depends on the country, and that presumably, for example, it might be quite tricky given all of the impositions if you try to transfer money to Yemen at the moment, because no doubt the Foreign Office in America and all that kind of stuff would have views on Yemen, and you may have to dot more I's and cross more T's than if you were sending it to, Egypt or something.
Correct, yes. The price does vary by country and by, as I mentioned, corridor. but also by the particular negotiations of the partnership agreement. As an example, though, again, bringing it online makes it cheaper, but when you send to something like mobile money, in Kenya, for example, we send to M-Pesa. From the UK, if you send £200, that would cost you £2.99.
So hang on, so I'm slowly working this kind of thing out. That's 1.5%, okay, which compares to the, you know, roughly 10%-ish in the old way. So it's roughly a factor of 10 cheaper in that way.
Yes. You've also got the immediacy of that transaction. Oh, right. That is instant.
Oh, right. Does it go straight away then?
Completely instant.
Wow. So if I try and transfer you money myself, the BACS and all that kind of thing has been improved a bit in this country, but you still only would get my money tomorrow, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So actually I can transfer money there to Uganda faster than to Hammersmith.
Right.
Interesting.
And again, these are things that people in these countries are used to
well.
Yeah, there's this demand, the expectation that it takes 3 to 5 business days or even a day
is
just absurd to a lot of people.
So that was one example, which would be 1.5%. And then in terms of the most complex sort of combination that you guys deal with, what would that kind of look like and what rates are those then?
Well, for example, we just opened up to Tunisia recently. And let's say if you send, use a higher transaction, £1,000 to a bank in Tunisia, that with us will cost you £14.
Right. So that's 1.4% again, isn't it?
Yes. If you send via Western Union, I looked at that earlier today, it's going to cost you £81.
Right, which is 8.1%. I'm glad you chose an example. It's easy for me to do the arithmetic. So what's the most expensive kind of, so just in terms of your price range, I mean, 1.5%, you've mentioned a couple of examples. What's the top of the shop in terms of?
So we offer minimum fees. Our minimum fees are very low.
Right.
And typically, you know, again, depending on the corridor, in some cases you'll have a flat fee. So US to Mexico, for example, is going to be $3.99, no matter what amount you're sending.
Okay.
And if you're sending from the UK to Mexico, again, it's £2.99 for transactions even up to £10,000. So either the flat fees actually have been very popular, especially we've seen people from the Philippines blogging about it.
So the flat fee is, sorry, stupid. So the flat fee means I pay the same rate regardless of whether I'd send $10 or $1,000.
Yeah, and we offer that in a couple of specific corridors. Minimum fees, our minimum fees in the UK are 95 cents in the US.
Right. And I'm just wondering whether in some cases it's cheaper to transfer money to what used to be called when I was young, the third world, and then transfer it back to another bank account in the UK than it is actually to transfer it by chaps for 25 quid or something. But that's the other thing.
Well, if you experiment, let me know.
Yeah. Well, maybe after this podcast goes out, you get loads of people in the developed world sending their money to the developing world and bouncing it back just to get it transferred instantly.
Yeah. And the other thing is, too, that at least customers tell us that they're really satisfied with is that the fees are transparent. You know immediately what you're getting before you go through with the transaction, which is also very different from a lot of the models used by the traditional offline players.
Yes, and that's a typical fintech advantage, which is that the new fintech has to be simpler, clearer, cheaper, and other things like that, which is why the whole sector's growing, of course. Coming on to the sort of challenges for all fintechs these days, even if it's digital, it still tends to be a bit tricky. Things like AML and KYC, anti-money laundering, know your client, anti-terrorism, all these kind of things. So if I'm signing up today as a new client, if I'm, a Filipino made in Hong Kong or Filipino made in London and I'm trying to send it back, how long do those processes take typically?
Again, it depends. As I mentioned, to use our service, we don't accept cash as a pay-in method. So already you will need to have a bank account to use our service or a credit or a debit card. So you will have gone through a KYC process with those institutions already.
Are you allowed to port that over then? So for example, I come to you and I'm with Barclays. Is that good enough for your purposes then?
Again, it depends where you are.
If I'm in Hammersmith, I'm Filipino and female. Maybe I'm using your imagination at this point.
We'd also ask you to provide, in many cases, a passport.
Right.
Or a
proof of identity.
Proof of identification. Yeah. And we work with a company that actually does identity verification through these online methods.
Ah, right. Okay. I was talking to Rich of Advanced Payment Solutions in the previous podcast about this kind of thing. And I don't want to go over the territory all over again, but just in terms of talking to different fintechs, they've got very different approaches. And some of them take quite a long time and some of them take less time. So it's one of the things where within the fintech world, there's sort of a variety of standards of how people are doing it, whether it's efficiently or thoroughly or, you know, how many decimal places you do it to, because, of course, you can never be 100.00% certain. But in a typical case then, so I'm a Filipino made in Hammersmith trying to send money back to the Philippines. Typically, if I've got the documentation you're asking for, does it take a day, a week, a month to sign me up?
It should take certainly within a day or less than that, especially because this company that we use, you can just take a photograph of your identification information. So you don't, there's again, no post involved. You don't have to send it to us in an envelope. You don't have to even photocopy it. It's just a photograph. And you can and send that through, and they have their own ways of checking that and verifying that information.
Yes, it seems to me that this whole industry, which needs to grow a bit more, of subcontractors within fintech that fintechs can usefully subcontract to. You know, you just do an API on a KYC. I mean, you know, let's say I set up a fintech. I'm not that interested in doing it. I know it needs doing. And if I can outsource that to somebody's firm and, you know, just send them an API and they send it back. So the know your client bit isn't too challenging. And then what about more tedious things like anti-money laundering?
Anti-money laundering especially has been a key part of our DNA from the start. Yeah. Our founder, Ismail Ahmed, was actually a compliance advisor for the UN's East Africa remittance program.
And he's from Somalia.
And he is from Somalia, now Somaliland, and from the very start has held this as an incredibly high priority for us to always have the best anti-money laundering processes. So, you know, a couple of things. We have the data to be able to check, and we have access to the databases to be able to check whether an individual has ties or potential ties with any organizations that would be unsavory. We typically would stop that transaction and then check it before allowing it to go through or not allowing it to go through. Likewise, with the data processing that we can do now is also to check for fraudulent activity and to look for patterns where fraudulent activity might be taking place.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that just concerns me wearing a sort of social interest hat, you're talking about America. I was listening to a very good rant recently by a chap you may or may not have come across called Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, who is an American guy who converted some time ago to Islam. And not only that, he's a traditional Islamic scholar, having gone the very scholastic route of learning it all. And I think he was one of the people called into the White House or whatever after 9/11. Talking to the president about how they respond. Anyway, he's got this very good rant, actually, about terrorism. I don't know where it was taken, but it's on YouTube. I'll put a link in the show notes for anybody that wants to listen to a rant on the whole thing. It's a very good one, basically going on about a whole bunch of examples of nutters who flew their plane into the Inland Revenue thing or whatever it is in America, and they were a madman, or some guy in Norway who plots for ages to shoot people up. And he's a madman as well. But then goes through other examples where actually they're not madmen, they're Islamic terrorists. And he didn't actually use the word complete hypocrisy, but which is two words anyway. But he is saying that America needs to have a standard for what is terrorist is in the first place. And so when I grew up, what in that kind of language you would now call Christian terrorists, so the Christian terrorists from Northern Ireland were busy blowing up places on the mainland, but nobody called them Christian terrorists. You know, you never hear of Christian terrorists, but these days, sadly, Islamic terrorists is always sort of stuck together. Anyway, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf's rant is a very good one on this subject. And one thing that sort of slightly concerns me about this is that, to a large extent, this is a relative opinion. I'm occasionally amused by studies around the world where, depending on which country you go to, America is seen as the world's largest terrorist organization. And sadly, the British tend to go along with that. And of course, not just picking on America, I mean, Russia also. So we're mentioning Afghanistan, which Sheikh Hamza mentions in his talk. And he said the Russians killed 1.5 million in Afghanistan, and we don't know how many as a West we've killed in Afghanistan. You know, and now you'll say they're terrorists, apart from the fact that Al-Qaeda was funded as the opposition to the Russians and all this kind of stuff. So those people who don't know much history can naively think, oh, these people going around causing terror are the terrorists, but there's a whole background to it. Anyway, cutting a long story short, and it's not a rant, but it's a mini waffle about a rant. One of the things that does concern me, frankly, is that this terrorist word tends to portray a large part of the globe, which happens to be Islamic, as if we're in a new crusade, as generally terrorist. Another country is left alone. There was an example I read on the BBC website just the other day. Peter Oborne, who's the associate editor of The Spectator, and who resigned from the Daily Telegraph because he wasn't allowed to write articles about HSBC closing bank accounts, was talking about the example where recently HSBC has written to several prominent British Muslims closing their bank accounts down. And, you know, these are people who have lived here sort of 30 years and all that kind of thing. And suddenly, you know, this chap and his wife had their bank account closed, and purely because they went to the Finsbury Park Mosque. And his article was saying that when he drilled into it, that 49 of the world's largest 50 banks use a company called World Check, a database owned by Thomson Reuters to check people for terrorism. And the long and short of this is that sort of post 9/11 world, banks are being fined billions and billions and billions. But then there's this one kind of database behind it. And surprise, surprise, you can be a kind of normal British law-abiding citizen. But if you happen to be Muslim, your bank accounts get shut down. And now, without trying to sort of start any sort of religious wars here, that probably doesn't happen to Christians or Jewish people or Buddhists or Taoists. I'm not sure many are Taoists. I'm slightly Taoist myself.
It is certainly a challenge. And even some names are very similar. The name Ishmael, for example, unfortunately, comes up a lot of times. But what that doesn't necessarily mean ties to any kind of terrorist organization. But it, with those kinds of databases, it does entail an extra check. And that's an unfortunate part of the process. But when it comes to sending money and when it comes to ensuring that the money is going to the right place, those checks, we feel, are very necessary. You'd rather have the checks in place than let transactions go through that actually end up in the wrong hands. But an interesting reason, and another reason why we focus on mobile money so much, Somalia, for example, Al-Shabaab is trying to shut down the mobile money organizations because it's difficult, based on the KYC processes that they do themselves. Yep. It's very difficult to launder money through them. It's very difficult to access the financing coming through. Somaliland, on the other hand, where our founder is from, the mobile money organizations are flourishing. They have very stringent KYC and AML processes. They follow the FATF guidelines, which is the International Financing Guidelines for electronic money. Again, the ability to, for groups that are trying to access financing through those organizations is much more limited.
I guess the big picture takeaway from this is that, of course, none of us are naive, and we all occasionally see the news, and you know, the West's take on this does have, sadly, something of a religious slant in terms of foreign policy of the kind of countries that, sadly, Britain still keeps invading. You think we should have learnt by now, after several centuries of invading and killing foreigners, it's all a bit distressing. And that if you're some big, slow-moving hulk of a bank, then you will err on the conservative side. And I'll include a link in the show notes to Peter Obon's article. I mean, The Spectator, for those people who are abroad, is a right-wing British magazine, so it's hardly a left-wing take on this. And this tends to, sadly, preferentially pick on certain folks. Having said that, the advantage of being a fintech, and as you explain in terms of your founder's origins and your background in these countries anyway, is that you guys know these countries really well. You're specialists in it, and you know that actually some of the reality is that in many cases the standards are higher on the far side and the technology is better on the far side than it is here. So, you know, the old kind of British imperial attitude that London, or maybe even Hammersmith to an extent, is the heart of the empire is a little bit old-fashioned, because these countries are actually much more at the sharper end of terrorism than the UK or the US.
Absolutely. To add to that point as well, when it comes to mobile money services, a lot of the telcos also have data based on location, based on mobile money transactions, where it's sent to. Even when you anonymize it, it's a lot more available than the banks have. You know, they have a lot more rich data than banks even have on their customers.
Exactly. And the takeaway is that you guys are trying to enable migrant workers to send money anywhere legally, which are both good things. It's not always as easy as it sounds when you give the story that, oh, we're a fintech and it's 10 times cheaper. A lot of hard work has actually got into that. And going back to your founder, a lot of hard work coming up with policies in the first place. So moving on and wrapping up a little bit with WorldRemit. So, you know, you guys are in the online remittances business. It's not as simple as it sounds, but nevertheless, you do it very well by all accounts, and mainly the accounts of your customers, and you're doing it considerably cheaper. What's the future hold for you guys, and, you know, where are you going, and what are the key takeaways that you'd like the audience to remember about WorldRemit?
So the first thing I think to say is, you know, the future for us is mobile-to-mobile remittances. We're the only online money transfer company to be focusing heavily on mobile to mobile. That's instantaneous. What it does is enables people to continue their conversations when they're talking on WhatsApp or Viber or other instant messaging services, Skype, and they can just continue that with a money transfer. It's as easy as a text message. What that means as well is when we're sending from mobile to mobile phones in the developing world, and at lower cost, is that people are able to send smaller amounts more frequently. Yep. So it really is enhancing that experience for the customer and helping them to retain their ties and be a lot more close to the family members that they have left behind. In terms of what we are going to be focusing on, we are a partnerships business through and through. We continually work on building partnerships with mobile money organizations, telcos, banks locally, and in particular to expand geographically. So we currently send from 50 countries to over 120 countries, and we're going to be continuing to expand that list. We're growing rapidly, even as an organization. Around this time last year, we were about 30 or 40 people, and now we're close to 200 in the organization. We've just opened up offices in the US and are expanding there as well, so hoping to open up new corridors. Our revenues last year, in 2014, tripled.
And didn't you raise $100 million or something like that?
We did, yes.
I'll pay for nice smart offices nearer than Hammersmith.
Exactly. So we raised $140 million in the last 9 months from VC investors, Accel partners, and technology crossover ventures.
I always like that kind of job no one's ever given at me, which is that, oh, Mike, we just raised $100 million and we need someone to spend it. Okay, that's my kind of job, actually. So if you guys need someone to spend $100 million, give me a call later. I'll apply for the job of spending your $100 million for you. Good. Well, I think that's been very interesting. Time's gone by very quickly as it is. And I think there's a number of details hidden away in all of this, which is more subtle than people might imagine. And a lot of ironies around the fact that actually, in many cases, in old money, the third world is a darn sight better off than the first world is. And then also some insight into the AML processes that are focused on by the telcos in these countries in the first place. It's not just a question, as can often be seen in the old financial services sector, that banks have got to be very careful where they send the money to. Quite often there's a much smarter organisation at the far end that's done it better. And as I said at the beginning, it's really nice to speak to a fintech which isn't just about the enriching the fat capitalists, but the reality of what you guys are doing is that you're transferring a lot of money for often pretty poor people working in very difficult circumstances, roughly 10 times cheaper and a darn sight easier. And to me, that's a really noble work to be engaged in. So it's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.